step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
We made this.
I dropped a bomb. The whole world is watching for my next move.
You're the number one trending topic ahead of tater tots. And the Pope followed you.
Wow.
Okay, no, this is not the... Is this the real...
Right.
No,
great.
I don't think
Thanks,
this
Greg.
Is a Pope.
My family have disappeared. I need to know where everyone is and what everyone's thinking.
There he is, the little man who started this big war.
Right now, I'm the real you.
Sure, and I'm the real you.
You sound deranged.
As I understand it, you want to take down your dad without implicating yourself.
Correct.
And without damaging the company to the extent that you lose control at your shareholder meeting.
Do you have an actual case, Ken?
Yes, I can kill him.
Is he going to watch?
Could we make a note in the minutes that he's watching us?
There's blood in the water. Sharks are coming.
We're going to lose the company. We're going to lose the fucking company today.
Investigation's looking pretty bad.
I'm focused on not going to jail.
Logan says we have to take these. Cyanide pills. It's a mint, you doofus.
No one's on my side in this. I need you to protect me, Pinky.
We don't beef up soon. I think we end up someone's lunch.
When will your father die?
With due respect.
No.
Obviously, hugely looking forward to my father dying.
Right.
Where does this end?
This friction. I thought my family was fucked up. This is next level.
Roman is a knucklehead. Shiv is a fake. Kenny is screwy. I've seen more than any of them.
This life is not for everyone. It's a number on a piece of paper. It's a fight for a knife in the mud.
I'm a good guy. I'm better than you.
We'll fucking beast them. We'll go full fucking beast!
Hello and welcome to Scheduled Programming, the official TV podcast for the We Made This podcast network. I'm your host Baz Greenland, and Scheduled Programming is a show taking a closer glance at new television, examining the good, the bad and the ugly of the small screen. In this episode we'll be talking about season 3 of HBO drama Succession. And joining me to talk Succession is author, writer, co-host of the 250 and regular guest on the X-Cast, and one of my favourite TV reviewers, Darren Mooney. Hello, Dan, how are you?
I'm good. How are you, Baz? How's life?
I'm good. Yeah, it's been quite a while since we podcast together. I think we did some of the X-Cast X-Pod ones, which didn't we, way back when,
the marathon that was.
Yeah.
It was 2 and 15 minutes, I think, was to get through the whole season before the relaunch or something, if I remember.
It was something like that, yeah. It was quite fun. So, we've been into kind of podcast together for a while. So, and obviously, talking Succession, what a podcast to talk about. It's going to be great. So, I think with each season, Succession seems to be getting more and more critical acclaim. Do you kind of regard it as one of the best shows on TV?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, Succession is, for my money, one of the best and most consistent returning shows on television. I was a reasonably early adapter in that I think I jumped on around the fourth episode. In fact, I watched the fourth episode first, which is the episode where they have, I think, Logan's 80th birthday party. And then I went on to Sky and I end up discovering that was not the first episode and end up kind of like trying to disjoint and get the whole thing together with the stroke and figuring out that I'd accidentally watched the first three episodes in the wrong order. But no, I really, really loved it. Fell in love with it over the course of that first season, like I think a lot of people did. The big moment, I think, was for the shareholders vote meeting. I think in the first season was the point where I really started to fall in love with this and go, this may be a momentous piece of television that we're kind of watching. And I know the internet does love Succession, and I know that that is perhaps, again, it's an internet's boyfriend kind of TV show, perhaps, where its cultural impact and its impact in the real world and its number of viewers maybe doesn't correlate to the amount of attention and love that it gets online. Although I am always thrilled to see that its viewing figures are jumping consistently between seasons. I think the third season finale, Consolidated, had the highest ratings the show has ever had, and I think it jumped something like 1 million over the second season finale as well. So I'm really thrilled that it seems to be finding an audience through word of mouth. But yeah, no, I absolutely love it. I think it's fantastic. And to talk specifically about the third season, I think this is interesting because I think while the third season was on the air, obviously it's still a show that is really, really loved online. I think it's one of the rare TV shows that gets like weekly coverage from The Atlantic of all places, which gives you like a perfect sense of how unique this is in the television landscape. But there was a little mumbling of a bit of a kind of a, I don't want to use the term backlash, because backlash kind of makes it sound disproportionate, makes it sound bigger than it is, and also dismisses it in some way, shape, or form. But there was a response, I think, from some viewers in the third season that the show had kind of got stuck, or it was spinning its wheels, or it was moving in place. And I think I saw that in a number of like pre-airing kind of coverage of the show, which I think had covered the first 7 of the 9 episodes. And watching the season, I didn't really see that. And I think coming out of the finale, I think that cast everything before it in a whole new light. But I absolutely adored the third season, which I think we're talking about specifically today. But what about you? Yeah. How did you come to it? And kind of what's your impression of it?
So I think, I think Succession is definitely one of those shows that every season it gets a bit more kind of buzz around it. And to be honest, season one completely missed me by. I wasn't really aware of it all, and given that, you know, for many, many years I was the TV editor of a website that reviewed TV shows, I was like, how have I missed this show? And I think season 2 had started and was like 3 or 4 episodes in, and I thought oh, I started to hear a little bit of buzz with season 2, and I watched the first episode and thought, oh, this is quite good. I really like the cast is great, there's some interesting ideas. And then I basically binge watched because It was on Sky Atlantic here in the UK, and it was like, oh, you've got 29 days to watch 20 episodes. And for me, that's actually quite a lot. I tend to do so many other things in my life as well, that actually watching 20 episodes of a show that is a big hour-long dramas, and also my wife was like, they're all horrible people. She didn't want to watch it, because, but that's kind of the point in a way. And so I thought, no, I'm going to watch this. And I thought, well, I'm going to see how I get on. And I was like, I've got to watch this. And I was watching like 2 episodes a day in the final 4 days to finish season 2. And I thought, this is so, so good. And I was very, very excited for season 3. So when season 3 came around, I knew it was finally coming. It's been quite a wait, hasn't it? It's been a couple of years, I guess.
2 years, but yeah. They took last year off, I think. And obviously the pandemic meant that they shortened the episode count from 10 to 9 and everything like that. So yeah, no, it's been a while.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, the pandemic, obviously, understandably, has impacted a lot of TV. And it's been quite a wait. So I basically came into it just as season 2 had finished airing and watched it all. Like, oh, more now. And I had to wait 2 years. So I actually, because I binged watched it in the space of a few weeks, I did actually rewatch the first 2 seasons again over the space of a couple of months, took a bit more breathing room to kind of watch it and absorb it. And my God, yeah, it's just so much great stuff in there. And the performance of the characters. And these are characters that are horrible, horrible characters, but you love to watch them anyway. It's great. I think that's the point. These people aren't nice people. These are horrible people that, you know, really, really, we know they're people politically, ethically, they're not something you can relate to at all. And it's fun to kind of watch it unfold and watch kind of the good people like cousin Greg, who gets caught in their web of it as well. And season 3 was great. I kind of, a couple of things, board meetings tend to be shareholder meetings. Season 1, that episode of the shareholder meeting when
Kendall's stuck in traffic.
Kendall,
and
yes.
And Logan is there, which is great. It's like, is he going to leave the room? He's not going to leave the room.
Exactly. That was so tense. I was like, yeah. Oh my God, what is going to happen? That was the first episode. I thought, wow, I've got to keep watching. Yeah. I've got to keep watching. And season 2 had a lot of great stuff there, particularly when they were more and more with Shiv in it. And season 3 had some really great stuff, but I think it was such a great cliffhanger that maybe I think it's why people kind of like, oh, where's it going? Because once you got past the momentum of, Kendall betraying Logan, and that brilliant scene at the end where he's on TV at the press conference, and kind of Logan gives that kind of slight proud smile. Yeah, I was like, where's this going to go? It doesn't necessarily go as you expect, and kind of almost wraps up halfway through. Think, oh, this is different. And but then, you know, the episode when they bring it back and another shareholder meeting was one of my favorites. And then those last couple of episodes, that finale, the last 20 minutes of the finale of season 3. Was astonishingly good TV, and now I want season 4.
Well, what I will say, actually, in defense of season 3, and it ties back into that point you made where these are all horrible people, and one of the things I actually really love about Succession, and I do wonder if this is one of the things that's a benefit of it not being a breakout hit like Game of Thrones, is that I think people watching Succession know that all these people are terrible, terrible people, and there is no singular hero of Succession, and that even the characters who, as you point out, present themselves politically as nice people. So you have things like Kendall, who is making an argument that his dad is a sexist, misogynist dinosaur and the company needs to be taken down and the patriarchy needs to be dismantled. He's just doing that as a way of working through his own issues and a way of like cementing his own position and trying to progress his own agenda. Shiv, who presents herself as a kind of a, you know, she's a Democrat in the first season. She's working as a campaign advisor to a Democratic candidate. But the show is very clear that that's an opportunistic thing for her. It's her basically sticking her boot into her father, and she will happily betray her principles at the first sign of trouble. I mean, even in, and again, one of the, like, so many standout episodes in this season, but the episode where they're like literally picking the next president, I think that's what it takes. Like the sequence where she is arguing quite correctly against the spoiler outsider bomb throwing candidate, and is making very good moral arguments for the idea that you don't want to elect somebody who is pushing the Overton window and trying to throw, I think, union workers out of it, I think is how she describes it.
Yeah.
But she's making that argument precisely because the boring centrist candidate has promised that he will help her oust her father and get her into the position of authority. So any authority that she has is completely undermined. And again, anything that she says about like wanting to change the system, she's implicated in all the stuff Logan's done. She, you know, at the end of the second season, she convinces a sexual assault victim to keep quiet and recant her testimony because it suits her political position to do so and her position within the family to do so. That moment at the second season finale where even like Rhea won't go, the kind of like ruthless CEO played by Holly Hunter, like won't go to the meeting, like just on like there's a moral line she won't cross. And Shiv, on the other hand, who's always presented herself as kind of righteous, self-righteous and self-important, self-serious, will happily do that if it will get her into her father's good books and get cemented. And I think the show works because, like, it doesn't expect you to treat any of these people as, like, fundamentally good people or heroic people or secretly deep down nice people. But I think to bring it to the point that you said there about, I think I would speak up in defense of the third season feeling like it is spinning its wheels or feeling like it's retreading old ground, or that point you made where you have the bombshell at the end of the second season where Kendall is like, oh, you know, literally going to trying to kill his father on television. I love that Connor's like, you need to stop trying to kill dad.
Yes,
that's his
that.
Big note. That's a wonderful line. But like the idea that like you, that's that moment is amazing. And you're like, this might actually kill him. This might actually end Logan's reign. This might actually bring the whole House of Cards coming down. And I really like that the third season is very much a too big to fail season, where it becomes quite clear early on that however radical that move was and however shocking it was and however stunning it was momentarily to Logan and Waystar and everybody involved, people in power don't face consequences in that way. Like, even Tom doesn't end up going to jail at the end of it. It very quickly becomes clear that Logan's not going to face any consequences. There might be the possibility of Tom doing jail time, and that is very quickly brushed aside at all. And by the time you hit, say, the sixth or seventh episodes of the season, which are like the episodes where they're picking the president and Kendall's birthday party, it's completely eroded and washed away because these systems don't change. We know from experience that like these people who do terrible things don't actually face that much punishment. And you can point to any number of examples of that, like things like the, you know, the cancellation and the Me Too stuff where people like were called out and were acknowledged as offenders. But outside of extreme cases like Harvey Weinstein, you almost immediately get them reinserting themselves back into public life. Things like Mel Gibson reportedly directing the fifth like Lethal Weapon movie, for example, all that sort of stuff. You have like things like the too big to fail stuff after the recession, where you're like, one person went to prison for all of that because these companies are literally protected and enslaved in the ways that they are. And I think one of the things I actually really like about the third season is that it is deliberately structured so that it reminds you of the first season. Like, the rhythms and the beats of it are very, very similar. Like, for example, the first season opens with Logan's 80th birthday party. And then the third season has Kendall's 40th birthday party in it as well, kind of mirroring each other. You have the shareholder sequence, which we mentioned in the episode from the first season. And as you point out, that's a riveting piece of television because we've not seen it before and it seems new and exciting. And it looks like Kendall like might be within inches of winning and it just goes the wrong way. But then you have the shareholders meeting in the third season where you have the exact same scenario. Kendall is on the phone remotely. Yes. Frank is like, oh, he's not well. It's like, that's lies. That's not true. And you have like, Logan has recused himself. And you have, is it Hope Davis looking at the Sandy looking at the window going, is he just going to stand there and stare at us while we do this vote? And it's literally designed to remind you of that sequence. But there's no tension because you know that like Logan's in no danger whatsoever through this.
Yeah.
And even the decision to have the finale as a wedding, as a two-part wedding, where you have like the two final episodes are about a wedding. And again, you have like the first season, you know, the first season is Logan's birthday and the third season is Kendall's birthday. You have the like father-son intergeneration thing happening. Mm. You have the inverse happening with the weddings, where the first season wedding is Shiv and the third season wedding is Shiv's mother. And you have this kind of, again, this huge thing that happens there as well. And I think it's very clever because it's designed to lull you into that idea that like nothing changes for these people. Nothing matters. Nothing's actually going to like upset this little bubble in which they live. And again, we mentioned the COVID stuff. I love the decision to, well, first of all, the decision to set this in a world where COVID apparently never happened. But I also like the implication that these people are so insulated in their bubbles that they could be living through COVID and we would just never know it because it doesn't matter to them. That aspect of the third season I genuinely love, and I think is a lot cleverer than people have given it credit for, I would argue. But that's kind of my take on it.
Yeah, I mean, I think you say mounted defense. I think I'm with you that season three is a great season of TV. I think it just took a little bit longer to realize kind of exactly what that season was about. And I do love the parallels to season one, absolutely. And
I mean, Logan pisses on the floor in both of them, right? Because the opening scene from the first episode is Logan pissing on the floor. And then you have, like, the UTI infection.
Yeah.
Like, at the crucial moment that almost brings down the company as well. Sorry, I'm jumping all over you.
Yeah, no, but there are so many great moments, aren't there? But yeah, I think that's what's kind of great about it, particularly having this longer gap between seasons as well. You thought season two was going to be a game changer. Season two was going to shake the very foundations of this show. And then you go, it's the same thing. And it's great and it's horrible to watch. I think where things change are probably perceptions of characters, but it's kind of one of those things like Shiv is a really interesting character.
Yeah.
And in the first season, she's almost like the outsider noble Democrat, though she's still quite bad. But you kind of on Shiv's side, you kind of like Shiv, and actually Tom is horrible. Tom is just the worst. For season one, I hated Tom, but I hated Tom. Yeah. And it's completely reversed in season three. Season two is about Shiv basically going through Kendall's journey, and she does that in season three as well. I'm thinking, well, I can have the power, and it completely corrupts her. But then you really see in season three that you think, oh, Shiv's the good one. Yeah, you know, the others are all horrible in their own ways. And you kind of see through Kendall's bravado and, you know, things at the birthday party that are utterly cringeworthy. But you absolutely understand where that's coming from.
Well, again, and Arrested Development, he's recreating his own childhood. Like, these are people who are in such a bubble, they never have to grow up or change. So,
But Shiv is the one where you thought, okay, well, she's trying and she's trying to do a few good things. So in this season, she tries to get a woman on the board, but that's because she wants to get on the board and she keeps getting shot down all the time. And you do feel for a bit, and then you realise, she's actually a really, really horrible person. And I think that one of the biggest, if you're talking about game changers, you start to think, poor Tom, and where did that come from?
Yeah, I mean, That's the thing. Like, and again, even like again, the way in which the show will pull this kind of rug out from under you and lull you into this false sense of security. I mean, there's a lot of stuff to talk about with Tom. I think the show's game with Tom in the third season is absolutely amazing, and it's so well written, it's so well structured, and they clearly have laid all of the stuff out beforehand. Like they clearly, again, like most TV shows, they have a good idea where they're going to end, but they're seeding it very carefully throughout. So things like, for example, you know, obviously the sequence where he goes and tells Logan, I want to, you know, I'm happy to jump on this grenade, I'm happy to sacrifice myself, and you have that moment where Logan pats him on the back, which gets obviously replayed at the finale as well. You have the sequence where, like, when Logan has the UTI, Tom is like taking him to the toilet, and there's a moment where Logan, with his UTI confused brain, is like, son, I'm really proud of you. And it's like, oh, Tom is now kind of, he's not just the son-in-law, he's the son. And even the little things where, like, you have this relationship that Shiv and Tom have always had. And, like, I think in the second season finale, it's Logan who sums it up, which is, like, you married beneath you because you are afraid of being hurt, because you wanted somebody who was no physical or intellectual or, like, you know, economic threat to you. You settled because you wanted somebody who knew that he wasn't good enough for you. And I mean, here you get that reiterated in like the dirty talk sequence in the penultimate episode. And again, like, this is the thing that I love about Succession thematically, is that it's obviously about power. It's one of the things that power is kind of fascinating, you know, why we are drawn to power and what power does, where power is basically, in the world of Succession, it's the thing that allows you to hurt the people beneath you. It's that thing that Caroline says in the penultimate episode of the third season, which is phenomenal, when she's talking to Shiv, and she says, you know, why she never had a dog, because Logan never had anything that he loved that he wouldn't kick to see whether or not it would come back to him. And one of the things that I really love about Succession is that you watch it, there's like trickle-down abuse in it, where characters will get abused, and then they will leave the room, and they will abuse the person lower than them on the food chain. Tom is a great example of this, because Tom is Greg. Greg is Tom's punching bag, so that whenever like he gets humiliated by Shiv or Logan or Roman or Kendall, he can just punch down at Greg. But there's moments, like I think of the first season, when like Logan tells Roman to get the fuck out of his office after embarrassing him, and Logan just like punches Greg in the shoulder as he's leaving. Or he kind of like walks past an intern and says, what the fuck are you looking at? And you get little moments like that, or moments where I think like when they're going to Argus, or the kind of like the conference that's meant to be Davos in the second season.
Yeah.
Like you have Logan like bollocking Kendall out of it in the front of the plane, and Kendall goes back into the back of the plane and just bollocks the lawyers out of it because he has the power to do so. And I think like it's interesting that like on Succession, and it's a thing that you mentioned with the second season finale where...
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right. ChumbaCasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Pain and love and suffering and hurt and abuse are so horribly intertwined because power is so important to these people. And the only way that you prove that you are somebody worthy of respect in the world of Succession is that you have the power to hurt other people. So it's that moment where Kendall tries to kill his dad at the end of the second season. And as you point out, you have that shot of Brian Cox's face, and he seems proud. For the first time, he seems proud of Kendall. It's that moment where, like, after being emasculated by Shiv, and after being told, like, you're not good enough for me, how Tom responds to that is to you know, do what he threatened to do earlier on with Nero, is to kick his wife down the stairs and to marry the eunuch. He, you know, betrays Shiv to Logan and then obviously goes and gets Greg on his team. And it's like, yep, yeah, that is kind of how that works. I've emasculated you. I've proven that I can hurt you. Therefore, I am worthy of your respect. And in the world of Succession, everybody's so broken that they think that's what love looks like. The moment, like, how Tom convinces Greg to sell his soul in the final episode is like, can I get a Greg? Like, can I get somebody that I can kick and punch down on? And Tom's response, you can get 20 Gregs. And like, it just, like, again, it's trickle down abuse, which I think is amazing. It's one of the things I love about the show is that little attention to detail that, like, plays so consistently across the show's seasons and themes and relationships that it's the key, I think, to understanding how it works, perhaps.
Absolutely. And I can understand why people go, why would you want to watch this? Because it is horrible people being horrible to other generally horrible people. And it is a cycle of abuse. But it's just so fascinating the way it's done and the way it's performed. And you get insights like there was the scene between Caroline and Shiv in the penultimate episode.
Yeah.
You got everything about their relationship in that scene when Caroline basically said, yeah, I abandoned you at 10, kind of to protect you, but also because, you know, the whole thing about the discussion about the dog and so on.
And also because you chose, and it's like, I was a kid. You almost, you're on Caroline's side for a moment because you've seen how horrible Shiv can be to Tom. And you know that Shiv is manipulative and you know that Shiv can, like, push the buttons. But also Shiv's response is, but I was 10. You can't really blame me for that. And it's like, you see how that becomes ingrained, which is fascinating.
Absolutely. I always watch title sequences anyway. I'm with people who skip a title sequence. Like, no, you've got to watch title sequences. It's part of the show. Yeah. But I always kind of watch every title sequence with those childhood images dotted in, with kind of like sometimes something can happen and you get a new perception of what's happening in those shots that you maybe not have seen last time you saw it on the previous episode as well. And it's all about that desperation, ultimately, to please Dad. And I find it really odd that they planned to essentially off Brian Cox's character at the end of the first season. He was only going to be a one-season character, and I think this show wouldn't be this show without him. I mean, you would get the return of cycle abuse and the power play and what's going on between the siblings, and that would still be absolutely fascinating to watch. But Brian Cox is an absolute force of nature on this show. He's utterly terrifying. You see that in that final episode as well. And I think would be a lesser show if they'd gone with that decision. So I think, thank God they actually decided to keep him on, because he starts Succession at his weakest and he just gets stronger and stronger. Season 3, he's never been stronger, to the point when he absolutely destroys his children. And it's like a car crash. It's so horrible, but you can't not watch what's happening and just get absorbed in the drama and the horror of this abusive relationship between the father and children.
Well, I think I understand the urge to have that kind of like idea of the first season character who's killed off, and then you have like the consequence of it, like the Game of Thrones approach that you have with Sean Bean. And Brian Cox is certainly the most famous member of this cast, so you can see why like they would be like, okay, we get Brian Cox in for a season, we kill him off. But on the other hand, I think in the long term, it suits the show thematically because, you know, again, you could argue one of the big themes of like the 21st century has been this argument that certain older generations have had difficulty getting their hands off the proverbial wheel and kind of like letting like younger generations kind of step up and kind of like take their place and kind of have responsibility and assume control. So you have this idea that like old, you know, and again, this is probably very heavy and very political for a TV podcast, but things like the amount of property that's held by older generations, the amount of material wealth that is held by older generations, the amount of political power and influence that is held by older generations as, you know, life expectancy has increased and all that sort of stuff, and how that sense you have of reluctance to surrender or hand over or accept the transition to a younger generation, I would argue politically and culturally as well. I mean, like, hell, just look at modern pop culture. Look at movies like Ghostbusters Afterlife. Look at movies like the Spider-Man No Way Home. Look at movies like, you know, Space Jam. Look at movies like the Rise of Skywalker. And you could argue that you can see in them a reluctance. Like, they are all Brian Cox. Lando is Brian Cox in The Rise of Skywalker, and Poe Dameron is Kendall, where he's like, I can do it, I can do it. And then Brian Cox is like, get the fuck out of my way. I'm just going to leapfrog you in the Millennium Falcon. But like, I think that that then becomes the show's secret weapon, because you have this thing with Logan where Logan is the way that he is because he grew up, like, he grew up poor, and he grew up in a background. And I love that the show has all these hints about what happened in Logan's past, and they've never been really articulate. You have the story of Rose, which is obviously his deceased sister, the implication that there was abuse at home, and the idea that, you know, he feels in some way responsible for not being able to protect Rose. That wonderful moment in the first season where he goes swimming and he takes off his, is it like a dressing gown? And you see all the scars on his back. And you understand that, like, the way that Logan behaves towards his children is likely because of how his father behaved towards him when he was a child.
Yeah.
And all that sort of stuff. And you see that kind of ingrained. But you also see, on the other hand, the idea that, like, Kendall, Shiv, and Roman, and Connor arguably most of all, but Connor also least of all because he's, like, least central to the show. Connor lives off in his own little dream world. He's in a ranch for most of the first season. He's running for president for the other two. He's not really interested in... I love that the writers have figured out that Alan Ruck is, like, a secret weapon. Because I think the story is that in the first episode, his big monologue about, like, water and how he'd share water with the little girl all came from Alan Ruck, because there was nothing in the script for Connor.
Yeah.
And I think you could argue that you've seen them as the show goes on try and get Connor more central. It's like in the third season, you have Connor saying, look, why can't it be me? Why can't I also succeed you?
And it's, like, it's laughable. Yeah.
Yeah. But also that wonderful moment. And I think it's, they do a similar sequence in the second season finale as well. But the bit where he's like, I'm the firstborn. Like, Kendall's like, I'm the oldest. And Connor's just sitting there going, no, you're not. I'm the oldest. But I love that you have the idea that all four of these kids have been so coddled and so protected and so insulated and so wrapped in, like, fiberglass and paper and, like, little kind of cotton, that they don't have the rough edge that their father does. And so he will never respect them. He will never respect them because he can't confront his own mortality or accept his own mortality in that way. If he accepts that he's going to be succeeded, it would mean... Like, there's that wonderful moment. The moment in the finale that I love is the moment where the Alexander Sarsgaard Elon Musk character kind of... Like, he figures out the button on Logan, where he's like, okay, look, you're old. You're medium old and outdated. You need to step aside. We're the future. And Logan kind of bristles at it. And then he makes the wonderful argument, and it's an argument that Kendall was never smart enough to make, which is the, look, I don't want to make you small. That's it. Like, that's the moment, I think, where you can see that Logan's like, I can accept these terms. These are not going to humiliate me. These are not going to make me seem weak. They're not going to make me seem old. They're not going to make me, you know, seem like I'm already in the grave. And I think that, one of the reasons why Logan won't accept any of his children succeeding him is because that would mean accepting that he is going to die at some point, and he can't do that. But I also think that one of the reasons why he will never accept any of his children succeeding him is because the lives that they have lived as a result of his incredible ostentatious Ralph means that they are nowhere near as rough as he is. They are nowhere near there. Was it, you're not a killer, he says to somewhat ironically to Kendall in the second season finale. But like, I think he honestly believes that they're not, even though he covered up, like, Kendall's involvement in the death of, like, a waiter. I think he believes that they don't have that killer instinct that he does, and therefore him giving them anything that he built would be worthless because they're not as tough as he was, you know.
Yeah, I think definitely. I think I think in that final scene of the season, when he basically goes, what are you going to do all these piles of billions of cash? I'm going to put my other piles of cash. You're not going to have it. You're going to make your own money. Yeah. You're going to go out in the world. I'm basically going to break you, destroy you, and send you out in the world with nothing. It's actually almost in his mind a good thing, because it's going to get him to toughen up and get some life experience. You know, maybe if they came back, he'll live to 120. In 10 years, 15 years' time, that one of them will succeed and come back, having made their own fortune, and then he might consider them. You know, it's like, that's the one it will take, really, to make them a worthy successor. And yeah, they are. They're all playing at being Logan. I think that's yeah. What's really interesting is that they find someone to abuse, to put upon. Yeah. They all find their own Greg in some form, and because they're playing at being their dad, and no one can be their dad. And yes, they haven't had the hardships that he had, so everything is very superficial. I think, yeah, you're right, you're about Shiv and her political leanings. It's all feels very superficial and glossy. It felt a bit more maybe in the first season. There was a bit more, maybe she'd be more moved. But as soon as she gets caught in her father's web, that's it. It all goes. Kendall doesn't really have an identity. You see that when he's alone at his party and he's there with the gold medallions being really cool and they're all his friends. And there's that really horrible scene. It took me back to like scenes when I was like a teenager. You know, I go to quite a few parties when I was like 16, 17, 18. But there was that weird moment when everyone's talking and you're kind of there by yourself. And it was when he walked out the room and just was on his phone. It was like, this is his party. And he had no one to talk to. He did the whole thing of, oh, I'm just going to check my phone a second. Because actually, to cover up that he has no one to talk to. And he's so utterly lonely. And they're all that in a way, you know.
That's the moment, like, from Tom's bachelor party where Tom turns to Greg and says, I'm having the time of my life. And it's like, who are you trying to convince, Tom? You or Greg?
Yeah, absolutely. That it's all playing. And same with Tom. Tom is all desperate to try and succeed. And it's weird. Tom has kind of found himself in a number of scenarios in season two and season three particularly, where he's in the room with people like Logan and they're making decisions and they almost ask him his opinion. And it might be superficial, but suddenly he's there. But
hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law.
See terms and conditions. 18 plus. You know, everything that comes out of his mouth is BS. And he can't do it. And you get the idea. I almost don't know why Logan puts up with him in a way. And Roman's the same. Roman is... he's possibly the funniest character, but he's also in some ways the most pathetic character. And I think that's what made that final scene get so heartbreaking, when he tried to stand up to his dad and was broken down. He experienced what Kendall experienced and what Shiv had experienced to an extent, because it's all about him playing. I kind of feel in a way that this... if season one was more about Kendall and season two is more about Shiv, season three was a little bit more about Roman and him trying to find his place and, you know, trying to make those deals and... succeed, you know, it succeeds in a way to kind of solidify the power and the company and make sure it keeps going. And but every single thing that comes out of his mouth is almost laughable, because it's he is playing at being dad and he doesn't convince anyone.
Well, it helps that like Kieran Culkin looks like a baby. He still looks like a teenager, even though I know he's in like his 30s or whatever. And Jeremy Strong, all the cast is absolutely amazing. And Strong's profile from The New Yorker, I know it generated kind of controversy online, but whatever method he's using, as long as he's not hurting other people, it works very well for him. Cox is absolutely amazing. Snook is fantastic. McFadden is also fantastic as well. But I think like that moment in the penultimate episode of the season where like Roman accidentally sends a dick pic to his dad, which sounds hilarious when you say it like that. But like Culkin's reaction to that, where like he plays that, and it's an entirely silent sequence, but it's like watching a balloon deflate in real time. It's staggeringly beautiful to watch him check, like hear the ping from his father's phone, see his father's head move, frantically check his own messages and discover what he said, and then try to sink into the own into his own chair.
Yeah.
And that wonderful shot you get of his father as his father walks out, and that intense close up on Roman's head as he just stares into middle distance and contemplates what he's done. And like that sequence, like that moment, like this is the thing where I think, like, for I think Kendall is past the point. Kendall gets past the point of accepting that his father will ever love him quite early in the first season, which is the bit where it is at the Sad Sack Wasp Chap. It's the first episode I saw. It's the fourth episode. It's the moment where Logan is meant to announce his retirement, but doesn't. That's the moment where Kendall realizes that whatever he does doesn't matter. He's never going to be. He's never going to come across like success or succession, like by following the rules and by doing what his father tells him. And I think Shiv as well, like Shiv has that whole arc in the second season where she gets bounced around a lot, and here where she gets bounced around a lot, and here where she gets like eviscerated by him, like used as a prop first of all to make the company seem like they're, you know, in feminist and kind of like moving forward, and then, you know, the stuff where, you know, he tells her to quit hovering around him after the UTI infection, and then when he uses her as a prop at the like the presidential thing, and he humiliates her by making her take a photo with the candidate that she had described as a Nazi, and she does it, which is like, again, that's the, so it's very clear that like Shiv knows that he will never respect her and he will never give her what she wants. I think Roman on some level actually believes, and again, it's the wonderful thing with Jerry, where I think Roman actually believes that these people might care for him on some fundamental level, despite his open cynicism. Despite his kind of like how his defensive measure of kind of, you know, making these terrible jokes about people, I think Roman actually thinks that his father might love him, because it is Roman who actually says, you know, what do you got? What are you offering me? I gave the seat sniffer. He got his like leg up. What do you want? What are you coming to me with? And it's like love. And I think it's Roman who says love, right?
He is Roman. Yes.
Yeah. And I think that like that moment after that where, like, he goes and he begs to Jerry, and like he's begging to Jerry, not in, like in public, like with Carl and, you know, Frank there as well. And Frank, who like he hates Frank, and he knows that like appearing weak in front of Frank is the worst thing that could happen to him. But he begs Jerry because he actually thinks that Jerry cares about him.
Yeah.
And it's amazing because you've had like, and again, this is the thing with Succession, which I think is very clever, because I've read interviews with Jesse Armstrong where all this stuff lands like a ton of bricks. All this stuff is completely shocking. And a lot of this stuff I will put my hands up and say the finale caught me off guard, because I, like a lot of people, expected a death in the finale. I was kind of expecting Kendall, because that New Yorker profile kind of reads like nobody expects to work with Jeremy Strong after it's published. And I say that with a great deal of affection. I don't think like it's sensationalist or anything like that, but it's very frank in a way that actors generally aren't frank about one another if they're going to see each other in a couple of months when they shoot the next season.
Yeah.
I expected that he might die. I expected that Logan might actually die, because you had a lot of press for Brian Cox, like, well, you know, I'm lucky that I'm around for the third season. They wanted me to go after the first season. I'm like, are you hinting at something? Are you kind of suggesting that or it's like, no, I think we're nearing the end of this. And it's like, okay, maybe you're going, maybe you're wrapping up. But I was expecting a death, and again the whole thing happens in the course of the finale. Like the suggestion of, like, is it Matthias, what's the name of the character played by Alexander Sarsgaard, the idea of like Sarsgaard basically kind of like buying the company all you know outright.
Matson.
Like buying the company all outright only emerges in like the first 15 minutes of the finale. And I know like he's only introduced two episodes earlier at the birthday party. And like he's suggesting a merger in the penultimate episode. But it's like you're 15 minutes into the finale before he's like, oh, I might actually just buy the company. And you've watched these things take place over like seasons and arcs and months. So what happens in the finale happens very quickly, and it works really well because of that. But all of it is signposted so, like, honestly and so effectively by the writing. So, like, that moment where Jerry, like, looks Roman dead in the eyes and says, how would that advance my position?
Yeah.
That's her repeating what she told him, I think, in, like, the second episode of the season, where she's like, you need to constantly ask yourself, how does this advance my position? Or, you know, the bit where, like, Tom betrays Shiv. Like, that reflects the conversation that Tom had with Greg, where he's like, I want to be Nero, and Nero pushed his wife down the stairs. The movie puts its cards on the table, and it doesn't try to wrong-foot you, it doesn't try to trick you, I think, too much, which I think is to its credit, because it really coheres in a way that is kind of brilliant.
Yeah, it's both shocking, but both natural at the same time. And I think the one thing that I heard people kind of online come out, like, oh my god, she was really bad. And it's like, yes, she's always been bad. She's just not been as bad as some of the others, maybe, at times. It's the Daenerys thing, isn't it, from Game of Thrones?
Yeah.
And
oh,
we were chatting a bit about it on Twitter, you, me, and Tony, weren't we, about it? And it's like, I diverted Game of Thrones for a second. Yes, it was shocking what happened in that penultimate episode of Game of Thrones, but you could see that happening from the first season. You know, she burned people alive. It's just going to happen.
She's a conqueror. Like, she's a
exactly.
Like, it's like, what do conquerors do? They conquer. They arrive. They use their weapons. They invade and they annex. And we know from experience, like, the entire point of the arc of the time. Sorry, we're tangent upon a tangent.
Yes,
but like the whole point of like the arc where she's in Essos and she's conquering these cities and these. Cities are not greeting her as a savior, they're greeting her as an invader. The whole point of that is to illustrate that, like, Westeros, which has its own political hierarchy, its own political system, its own actors who are invested in the status quo, is not going to greet a woman who shows up with three dragons as the rightful queen and get down on bended knee and accept her as their lord and savior.
Yeah.
And like, I think, and I do honestly quite like that twist in Game of Thrones. I think it's brilliant because I think it implicates the audience. Because the whole point of that twist is that, like, everybody in Westeros, like, has agency and has, like, narrative arcs. And we've been following them and we know their agendas and we're rooted in them and we're kind of rooting for them. So we know what they want, we know why they want it, and we know what they're fighting for. And we care about them because they're main characters. The thing with Daenerys is the plot is structured so that, like, Daenerys and Jon Snow, who are the most traditional characters, are literally at the edges of the map. So you have, you know, Daenerys is over in Essos and you have Jon Snow up north. And they are fighting not other characters, not like characters we care about, not characters we're invested in. They're fighting abstract forces. So Jon is fighting the White Walkers, which is a standard fantasy menace. It's an army of zombies. It's ice zombies. So it's a very clear, like, we like Jon. And we can continue to like Jon for the, like, six seasons of the show, because unlike anybody down in Westeros, he doesn't have to get his hands dirty with politics. Same thing with Daenerys when she's over in Essos, because none of the characters that she faces are actual characters. They're more abstract concepts to us. They're slavers. So we all hate slavers. And none of them are actual, like, characters who have agency or development. There's a character who shows up and is like, by the way, you killed all our parents. But we're like, we didn't really know anything about your parents except they were slavers. So we're fairly okay with her murdering all of your parents.
Yes.
And then when she comes to Westeros and she does exactly the same thing, we're like, so much of the audience loses their mind because we're so used to thinking of her as the unambiguous hero fighting the unambiguous villain that as soon as she lands in a world where we're like, oh no, we consider these people to also be heroes in this narrative, it gets thorny and complicated. And I think to give, like, I think that's good. And I think the way in which the internet reacted to the revelation that the blonde white woman riding dragons and declaring herself lord of everything, turning out to maybe not be the lord and savior, was maybe perhaps an issue with some online literacy.
Yeah.
Darren says very gingerly and very, you know, however you feel about it, you're entitled to feel. But my reading of it is that perhaps there was some of that at play. I think that Succession has been very good at, like, just consistently making it clear that these are bad. Like, even in the first season, like, we don't like Tom. Tom is not a nice guy. But Tom gets kicked enough in the first season that we're not rooting for Shiv when she's cheating on him. And, like, like, we get the sense that Tom actually does love Shiv. Like, he clearly, yes, some of it, yes, is, some of it is like power striving and all, like wanting to like advance his social position, and like how much of the wedding is about impressing his mom and dad, and like how much that matters to him. But he seems to like genuinely love her.
I think he worships her. I mean, yes, it advances him kind of in terms of the company and how he succeeds. But the fact that he's actually spoken about as a potential successor, I know it's kind of done in jest, but, you know, there's a reason, because he gets in that position. And but it happened,
like, having her kick him so much in the first season makes, yeah, us feel like she's not a good, like, we get a, yeah, sense, even when she's like arguing for abortion rights and like voting for the right side, we still get a sense that she's maybe not that nice a person, yeah, even, yeah, before she gets drawn in, I think, which is good.
And it's the upbringing as well. You see that more, yeah. I think that really comments in that scene with the mum in the third season. You know, you understand why she's as broken as he is, and you have a degree of sympathy for her, as you do for all the siblings. You say the same for Kendall, say even for Connor, really. You kind of understand where they've come from and the kind of the abusive and the pattern, you know, the power struggles, everything that's happened. It's almost, of course, they're going to be like this way, you know, and really go back as well. You can see it with Logan as well. You talk about the scars and so on. There are hints, actually.
And even Caroline, like, I mean, Caroline, yeah, is awful, and she, like, she's a minor character, but,
yeah,
like,
I love
you
Caroline.
Understand, yeah, but you understand that being married to Logan was probably exhausting.
Yes.
Like, you, like, no idea, like, how, Logan's latest wife, the one who
Marcia.
Marcia, yeah.
Yeah.
Like, that sequence where, who are you? What are you, Marcia? Aside from a machine for accumulating power, which I think is like, is that a line from Shiv at one point? But you get a sense of how hard it must be just to be married, yeah, to Logan. And, like, the sense in which Marcia has to be, like, Marcia has to be almost a business partner in the way that she behaves towards him,
yeah,
where she has to, like, she has to accept the infidelity, but she also has to establish the boundaries of said, you know, infidelity. And she also has to secure not only her position, but the position of her children from her earlier relationships as well. And to get, like, that as a surety. Well, again, because everything in here, because love doesn't exist in this world, how you measure this is by security, and how you measure security is by, like, actual concrete assets. And so, like, you understand, looking at, like, Marcia and looking at Logan, you understand why Caroline is, frankly, as terrible as she is.
Yes.
And how her being as terrible as she is probably contributed to how terrible her children are, on top of Logan being as terrible as he is as well. Like, it's all such a, like, a weird viper's nest, vicious circle thing, which is amazing how it allows the show kind of the best of both worlds, where you... What's that line? There's that wonderful line from Paul Schrader when he's talking about, like, writing, he's talking about writing Taxi Driver, and he's like, you need the character of Travis Bickle to be, and I can't remember the terms and I'm sorry about this, but it's something like understandable but inexcusable, which is basically where this lands. Or the thing where that line from, like, Red Dragon, which is probably a bit of an extreme example to pick, where Will Graham's like, yeah, as a child my heart bleeds for him, but as an adult he's irredeemable. And, like, I feel that way about most of these, like, even Greg.
Yes.
Like, and Greg is the character I find interesting, because I see a lot, Greg's the character I think a lot of people online kind of root for. And I love that, like, as the show's gone on, it's become as clear that Greg is just as craven as everybody else. He's suing Greenpeace. He's,
yes,
getting, like, cheered at the Conservative Action Conference. He's, like, trying to climb the dating ladder.
Yeah.
Like, as soon as power presents itself to Greg, like, and again, he kicks back. Like, you can see he takes so much shit from Roman for the first couple of seasons. Things like the you know, a Tom Sunday with Greg Sprinkles, I think, in the second season finale. And then you have, you know, the sequence in the third season where he's like, it's what we call kind of I don't know how you'd say it, a sex pervert. That's what he is.
Yes.
And you can see that it's like he enjoys that he feels so secure now that he can punch back at Roman.
Yeah.
And that kind of matters to him as well. Like, I like that even Greg is so... and even Greg's grandpa, who initially presents himself like like Shiv, as somebody who's like, this family is toxic and horrible, and Logan, you've poisoned the well of public discourse, I think is actually a line that he uses, and he quotes all this philosophy, and he's very high-minded. But every chance that he gets to make a difference or to affect the world, he declines to do. So he declines to vote against Logan at the shareholders meeting. He turns up to vote for Logan specifically at the shareholders meeting. And in the third season, when Kendall makes his public statement, you have that statement from like Greg's grandpa where he's like, I didn't like it. I don't like airing family business in public. And it's like, everything that you have said, you should be cheering from the rafters about this, because this is your chance to strike a blow against American capitalism and the beast and the monster that your brother has created. But actually, you fought into this in your own way as well. You just want to feel good about it. You just want to feel like you're not a part of it. While as like and then through that you understand why Logan hates him so much, because Logan's like, I pay for him to live up in Canada.
Yeah, exactly.
And like, all he does is complain about how awful I am. And you're like, he does. And he doesn't back it up. He's happy to just like pretend that he's a good person in some ways.
He's like Connor. He's very much like Connor in a way, actually. You know, he complains, you know, I'm not going to be part of this toxic family. I'm going to distance myself. I'm going to be better. But I'll have all your money at the same time. And it's like, you know, they're quite happy to take that money. And yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, James Cromwell is, you know, another great actor and, you know, has that sense of gravitas to the character of the granddad. But yeah, he's in it for himself. And talking to Greg suing Greenpeace is just genius.
It's a great plot. It's such a great plot. What are you going to do next? Friends of the Earth? Or
and then they're dated. The assistant, Kendall's assistant, media. And then they contest the Contessa.
Comfy, isn't it? Yeah. And then
there was a wonderful line. He said, don't let Roman marry her. He'll probably invade France. So many great lines.
That wonderful camera movement. And again, like, we'll talk in a moment in a second about how wonderfully direct, like, the show is wonderfully well written. Everything is posted. But that wonderful camera movement where the Contessa like leans into Greg and she says, oh, the weddings, they're so sweet. And he's like, yeah, they really make me move. And the camera moves over to Comfy sitting on the other side of Greg. She's going, God, this is so cynical. So it's like, yeah, it's awful. I love, like, even Greg the egg, who's like presented as this outsider, like, you know, this initially what in a worse show would be the audience identification character, like, has been so warped through exposure that he's just been kind of, he's become as corrupted and as tainted and as awful as any of these people.
Yeah, he very much is a proto Tom in a way, isn't he? Because you know, he's a character, you kind of thought, oh, Greg's going to come in, actually, he's going to overthrow him. You almost imagine that when you watch the first episode, when he came in, the finale is Greg's going to be on top, and he quite possibly will be. But now he's starting to get there. You're going, oh, but that's not right. But yeah, of course he is. How is he going to get there? And Tom's the same. And yeah, I mean, you mentioned a few times the Tom's betrayal of Shiv at the end. And I watched it once, and there was so much going on, I almost didn't pick up. I don't think it certainly hinted that Tom had betrayed Shiv, but I was never quite sure he was actually explicitly stated that he did betray her, or where it just hinted at. Like, it doesn't really matter either way. I think
she clearly believes that he does, because she winces when, like, it's that wonderful moment where he touches her and she flinches. And it's very much a moment of, it's that Godfather 2 thing, I know it was you kind of moment, where I think Tom not only knows, because like the door is open and Tom can see the kids in there.
Yeah.
And like, so Tom is aware when Logan pats him on the back that they see and understand why he's getting the pat on the back. Because it's so, and again, it happens, the show is so well structured, like it happens repeatedly. Like the thing with, the thing with the siblings going to visit Kendall, like when they go and visit Kendall, I think in the second episode of the third season, and Logan sends the box of donuts to them because he knows that's where they are. And you watch that and all the siblings are calling like everybody else. So Shiv is talking to Tom about like how she feels about it. And Roman is talking to Jerry about how he feels about it. And like, of course that gets back to Logan, because these characters are incapable of maintaining a closed circuit on each other. And like, even things like you have like moments where like the moment in like the, again, the picking the president episode where like Kendall makes that desperate, like, flailing for air, needs something pitch to Tom, where he's like, come over to my side, Tom, we can do this. You know, like, you know how desperate Kendall is because he's trying to recruit Tom. Mm. But that moment where Tom explains to him why he's not going to betray Logan, which is, I have watched you get fucked repeatedly. Like, I have seen you get fucked many times. Yeah. I have not seen Logan get fucked once. And that again is a moment where it's like, when Shiv gets on the phone to him in the finale, it's like, yeah, I need you ready to run this on the news network as soon as we drop this. And he's like, you know, so what's in it for me? What am I going to be? It's like, oh, you'll be high up. Don't worry about it. We won't forget about that. But the inevitability of that betrayal, which is just so, so good. Like, all this stuff feels like it is a surprise when you're watching it. But then when you think about it, it's like, no, that makes perfect sense. And apparently they shot several different versions of that ending sequence. So there's a version where Shiv didn't see Tom and Logan in the hallway, where it was just, I think, Kendall who saw it. And then obviously Tom would come in and he'd comfort her and she'd accept it. But they opted to go with the one where she saw him and she flinches as well. Mm. I think there's some speculation online that Shiv might be pregnant as well. Because the Nero story, when Nero kicked his wife down the stairs, she was pregnant.
Right.
There's this recurring subplot about whether or not they are going to get pregnant, for example. There's the fact that I love how much attention the show pays to characters not having sex, which we'll come back to. But the show makes a big deal of how Tom and kind of Shiv aren't really having sex, except they do have sex a couple of nights before, or, you know, at the kind of reception or the kind of pre kind of Caroline's wedding event, which would mean that maybe Shiv was pregnant by the time he got here. And the fact that when she gives a toast at Caroline's wedding, I know I'm going very deep on the Succession Reddit here, but when she gives the toast at Caroline's wedding, she's drinking water rather than wine. So there's been some speculation that she might actually be pregnant with Tom's child, which would add a whole other dynamic.
That poor child.
Yeah. It's a hell of a situation to end up kind of involved in.
Yeah. I mean, it certainly does take you by surprise. Let's talk about that finale. I think one of the reasons it's so shocking is because it kind of repositions Shiv, Kendall, and Roman as they bond and they become the heroes. I love that scene where they're out in the kind of back by the bins on the back there. And
he breaks down and so Roman's kind of massaging his shoulders.
Yeah.
And Shiv is on the phone, barely paying attention to him, rubbing his head he's a baby.
Yeah, he just said, you know, I killed a man, I'm broken by this. And she kind of pats him on the shoulder while facing away. It's like, but at the same time, there's this closeness between them you've never really seen. Even that, you know, you had it a little bit earlier in the scene where, I mean, again, maybe, you know, I kind of let so many things going on. I know the previous episode hinted the possibility that he might drown in the pool at the end of the previous episode. I never really believed that would be it. It would go then, but obviously the episode plays out. They have the intervention where Connor goes, but I'm the oldest. Hold on, you know, I'm here too. I'm relevant. But
said we'd be able to say our things. You need to stop trying to kill Dad.
Yeah. Oh, great. Adam got so good. But, you know, there was a hint there that they care. Yeah. But it's like, deep down, you always know they do care about each other a bit, but you don't really see that bond until that scene when they break down. And the fact that it's Roman who essentially comforts Kendall, you know, that massage thing, and he's there and he makes jokes and he tries to turn it into a joke, you know, well, you know, tries to replay what would have happened if he had been there instead and, you know, had a bad drink and so on. He makes light of it, but he does it to comfort Kendall. And for the first time, that the excitement in that car when they're planning this and she was on the phone to Tom and that, there's a genuine excitement because they're bonded, they're close, they're together. And together, that's what it needs to take down Logan. It's the three of them together. If they're bonded together, they can't be destroyed. And then they get destroyed. And it's like, so you think for the moment, this is the triumph. In a way that the season two ended with that almost triumph moment for Kendall, finally stepping back and out of his father's shadow. It's like, actually, that was the moment. This is the moment. And no, this is not the moment either. This is the moment when they get completely destroyed. So it's a phenomenal 20 minutes, that final part of the episode. And, you know, your jaw's hanging open the whole time. You don't know what's going to happen. You know, who's going to die? Who's going to win? Who's going to succeed? And even though is a Daenerys thing. You know, yeah, the fact that Logan destroys them, the fact that Tom betrays Shiv. The biggest surprise in a way was actually that Roman didn't break, actually.
Yeah. That surprised me. Like Roman didn't, because that's Roman has broken at every opportunity. Like it's the first season. Like again, like Roman, I think honestly believes that they are a family. Like I think Roman deep down believes that they are a family. So like you know, in the first season, Roman goes along with like you know Kendall during the attempted coup until Logan bullies him. You better be scratching your fucking ear, Romulus. Mm. You know that moment, that sort of stuff where Roman kind of tries to convince the Vulture tries to convince like the Vulture founder to go along and stuff like that, and like you know I think Roman actually does believe that they are a family unit. And again, even I think in the, and again it's one of those small touches, like again so much of the show is so like layers within layers, kind of like, you know, as above, so below, things reverberating down. But like when they go to Kendall's apartment, I think in the second episode, to talk about like plotting against Dad, it's very notable that like for all that like Roman's like, oh, I'm just spying on you for Dad, I'm not here to actually listen to any of your crap, he brings Kendall a pastry from the airport, which is a surprisingly like thoughtful gesture from somebody like Roman, and also kind of mirrors like the donuts at the climax, which are these donuts that arrive in a box from Logan as a very veiled or none too veiled threat. Was it, I'm like 98% certain he didn't send poison donuts to the home of his grandkids? But like you have this idea, like again, I think Roman actually believes that like him bringing a pastry to his brother is a good gesture, and the idea that you have in contrast to that Logan sending pastries to his kids as a threatening gesture, which is so good as well. Or things like the bagel that kills the rabbit, that kills Kendall's rabbit in the episode where like they accidentally kill the raisin, who is like the president, where they get the raisin to refuse to run again, which again is another bit of kind of layered imagery and stuff like that. But I think that Roman does actually, like, Roman believes that they're a team, because like he's the one who's like in the car, he's like, look, we don't actually make a bad team. And the bit where they're about to confront their father and he talks about, I think, is a water pistols in Bali, where like where Shiv and where Kendall convinced Roman to, like, they were all going to shoot their father with a water pistol, and Roman went in alone and presumably got horribly beaten, for one can only guess based on like past experience. Like there's a moment, I think, in the, again, in the Davos episode where Logan strikes Roman. Like, he actually physically hits him. And you can tell that it's not the first time that it's happened, from the way that the siblings react to it, from the way that, like, I think Kendall puts himself between Logan and Roman. I think Roman minimizes it and says, I barely made contact. And, like, the sequence, I think, in the following episode in the car, where, like, Logan's talking about it, it's like, oh, just about what happened, I didn't see you there. And Roman's like, no, of course you didn't. That's fine. It's not a big deal. I think Roman does genuinely believe that they're a family in a way that Kendall and Shiv don't. And I think that really worked for me. And things like, as you said, him trying in his own weird, dysfunctional way to make Kendall feel better about having killed somebody, which is like, and again, it's one of those things that is so amoral and so terrible. Like, this is a terrible way to talk about this, but it's also as close as these characters get to expressing love for one another that I'm moved by it. And I find like that portrayal fascinating. And I think, again, the moment that I really loved is so much of this is like laid out, so much of the show is playing its cards like in front of you without you even realizing it. The fact that the kids are always watching the wrong thing, they don't have their eye on the ball, again, lacking Logan's killer instinct. You have like so much of the final two episodes is Roman running around at his mother's wedding, worried about the prenup that she is signing to when she's marrying Peter Munyon. He wants to make sure that the prenup for the new wedding that they're going into, that is watertight, and that she and he know exactly what the terms of those are. And what ultimately screws the kids over isn't the prenup with Peter Munyon. It's the reopening of the divorce agreement with Logan, which was explicitly mentioned in the previous episode. Like, it's all of the stuff that Logan uses to outmaneuver the kids is brought up in front of them in the previous episode, and if they had been paying attention to anything outside of their own little bubbles, they might have put two and two together and figured out that, you know, they reopened, he wants the flat, he wants that social position and advancement, and he wants it from Logan. And so therefore, if we need Mum's supermajority, which she got in the divorce, the divorce which is currently being renegotiated, we should probably make sure that we have her on side before we jump in there.
Yeah.
And I love that they get so outmaneuvered, but they get so outmaneuvered by the show playing entirely fairly. It's a very, it's an incredible bit of like writing, but I was going to say writerly work, where the show has everything that you need to understand what's happening in front of you, but is moving the cards of the shells so fast that you're not paying attention to what you should be paying attention to, and therefore it lands like a right hook. It's masterful.
Yeah, absolutely. The moments you find something to relate to and you find their bond, you want to relate to it, and you encourage it and you want to go along, and but then you forget what show you're watching. And it's almost like
not going to have a happy ending.
No, it's not. I found the fact that the mum betrays him, that's horrible as well. And yet, but it's done in a very, oh, it'd be fine, dismissive way, because she doesn't care. It's like she doesn't do it to be cruel. She does it because she doesn't really care enough to try and understand what they're trying to do. It's an inconvenience to her. So her betrayal is almost one of neglect, whereas his one is one of, I mean, neglect is abuse, but you know, he's more overt, and she's kind of the other way. But I mean, they get betrayed by both parents. I mean, Shiv gets betrayed by a husband and both parents in the space of like a minute. It's horrible. And
what's that Shiv line? We just walked in on mum and dad fucking us.
Yes.
But like, and I mean, and we should pause here and acknowledge, like, and I'm entirely in this boat, so I find this is amazing. Like, whatever happens here, Shiv, Kendall, and Roman are never going to have to work an honest day's, like, work in their life. They're never going to have to do an honest day's work. They're going to get settled out. They're going to get, like, worst case scenario, they end up kind of, like, living lives of absolute luxury into their 60s. And, yes, you know, selling their, like, lifestyle kind of stories or whatever. And just kind of, like, retiring into anonymity. Living lives of luxury that you and I and most of our listeners will never know. I don't want to, you know, I don't want to prejudge the demographics from which our listeners are coming. But I will dare to say that, like, maybe 1% of our listeners will, you know, actually know, and 99% will not. But yeah, like, I love that the show gets you so caught up in this that it's like we are betrayed. Like, I do feel betrayed by what happens to Kendall and Roman and Shiv, even though I know intellectually that, like, they're going to be fine. Like, they're going to be fine, like, economically. They're going to be fine socially. And, like, I'm just like, the betrayal is so personal and so intimate that I'm emotionally invested in it, because it's such a, again, it's fathers and sons, fathers and daughters, mothers and daughters. It's this sort of, like, it's, again, it's this primal kind of Greek thing going on there, you know?
Very much so.
Yeah. And I love that the show is able to get you as, like, I know we keep going back to it, but that it gets you to invest in and, like, be emotionally open to and empathetic towards characters who, by all accounts, you should be rooting to see them disembowel each other. Like, this should be Titus Andronicus. Like, everybody should be dying horrible deaths and we should be cheering. But you kind of, like, when Kendall breaks down, you feel sorry for him against all odds. Like, when Roman breaks down, like, knowing that he's like, the worst person, you're like, I feel terrible for him. We talked about how much Shiv is the worst person, but when she pulls away from Tom, you're like, Jesus, that's heartbreaking. I love that ability to, it's something that I think a lot of the great TV dramas have, is it's like The Sopranos with Tony Soprano, where you, like, you accept that this man is, like, toxic to everything that he touches, but you're also like, I am so drawn in and so invested in and so fascinated by, and the performance is so compelling that I can't help but feel for this man in some way, and that makes me deeply uncomfortable.
It's very, very much so. Yeah, there aren't any heroes in the story. They're the characters you root for based on the situation. And I mean, yes, it's down to the performances as well. Yeah, Jeremy Strong, Sarah Snook, and
Kieran Culkin.
Kieran Culkin, yeah. They're so good. You know, everyone is great in this. And, you know, it's one of those shows where there isn't an issue with a performance, almost faultless to a T in a way. You know, some characters stronger than others, but when Harriet Walter turns up as the mom, she's fantastic. And
even the guest stars, like Stephen Root, like playing the head of like the Republican National Convention, you imagine? Or like the bit where Adrian Brody pops up for an episode.
Yeah, just for an episode, it's
and,
great.
And he's just gone. Like, it's like he's not a big recurring character. It's just like, here's Adrian Brody. He's an investor. He's going to give Logan a heart attack. And it's like, that's it. That's his one role this season.
But it's great. And yeah, I mean, the performances make it. I mean, the writing makes it and the performances make it. You know, if these characters weren't so good and weren't so nuanced as well, and there wasn't so much depth to these characters and to the background, the stories and the motivations, you know, I've heard it described as Shakespearean at times. And it really is. It really, really is. You know, the journeys these characters go through, poor Kendall's journey. Why am I saying poor Kendall? It's like, it's, you know, he's, you know, there's moments in this in the early on when you go when he's going to go down the kind of the route of light. He's going to be triumph, you know, good values and stuff and that. And then the moment he gets there, he just screws it up. You know, you see that the lawyer in his early scenes, and you could just see her frustration build and build and build, because he's a horrible person who is in this for himself and he's not trying to do what he's trying to suggest he's going to do. But I still go, poor Kendall.
Well, I mean, but and also, and again, this is the thing where even though this is a show that is, you know, it's very arch, it's very wry, it's very grounded. I mean, we might talk about the direction in a moment as well. But like, even though this is a show that is like very like literal in some senses, like it's a show that like it plays with its metaphorical imagery very, very heavily. We mentioned like how important pastries are a second ago, but it's very notable that like the big sin like underneath Waystar Royko is the cruise line. It's the floating on water. It's the ships on water. And like, again, the recurring kind of metaphor you have of the bodies being thrown overboard and all this sort of stuff. But like, Kendall is blaming the company for that and trying to argue that his father should be deposed because of his like abstract involvement in that. In that, like, you know, and again, you could argue about how much he did or didn't know about it. At the very least, he chose not to know. I think, like, at one point he argues to Shiv that, oh, I don't read my emails. You know, I have other people to do that for me. And, like, from what we know in the first season, that sequence where Jerry talks to Tom about the importance of being a sin eater, for example, or that moment where, like, Bill talks about, like, the death pit. I might not like it in the death pit, says Tom. Or says Greg. Greg, it's like, Greg, I might not like it in the death pit. But the bit where, like, Bill's like, oh, look, you can choose not to know, in which case everything's fine, and everything's always been fine, and it will continue to be fine. Or you can choose to know, and that way then you'll be prepared. And it's like this thing where even at the best of cases, even the best of cases, it's a sin of omission, and it's a sin of willfully looking away. But it's still an abstract sin. Like, even if Kendall's most extreme argument is correct, like, Logan wasn't tossing the bodies over the sides of these cruise liners. And while Kendall is making that argument, Kendall knows that he was in a car where a kid drowned. And again, that water imagery, it's very, like, it's very pointed, it's very specific that, like, it's the cruise line that he's blaming the company for, the bodies thrown overboard, whereas he himself very literally was with a body in water, drowning and suffocating, and ran away from it and chose to hide from it. And so you have this kind of, like, again, this thing where Kendall very self-righteously is talking about how, you know, his father is a toxic influence on the American discourse and how he's destroying civilization. And Kendall himself won't ever even consider the possibility of taking responsibility for what he did to that boy. And like, and to be fair, like, it's very clear that he does feel bad about it. However, like, you want to quantify that, the terrible sequence in the second season where he just pushes notes of money through the family's door, which is like, it's so vulgar and it's so awful and it's so horrible, but you feel sorry for both, obviously, the family of the kid, but you feel strangely sorry for Kendall because this is the only way he knows how to try and process this. And like, things like the bit in the, like, in this season where, like, that shot you mentioned from the penultimate episode, the closing shot where he sticks his head underwater after Logan's talking about how long was that boy sucking in, you know, underground before he started sucking in water, and you have Kendall holding his head underwater to try and feel that. But you also have, like, he's also clearly not going to face responsibility for it, because he's like, well, look, pay attention to those podcasters who are digging into the death of the waiter. It's like, I want to know if they get close to anything that might actually hurt me. So you have this thing with Kendall where, like, he, again, it's that kind of thing where, you know, you can understand and, like, want to root for him to call out all this terrible corporate malfeasance, but also his inability to acknowledge his own, like, privilege or malfeasance or his own awfulness and complicity in it. And, like, complicity that isn't, like, abstract or systemic. Complicity that is very literal. He was in the seat of the car next to somebody who drowned. I think that's, like, that's a fascinating dissonance in the show. And I think, like, it's so well constructed that you have the cruise lines and the drowning. And those are the two sins. And they're both water-related. Again, so good. The imagery is so good. The metaphors are so effective, and the parallels are so effective. I think it's great.
Yeah, absolute masterclass in writing. Yeah. So before we kind of wrap up, then, any kind of other final things you want to draw upon from season three?
Just want to note the direction, because I think I kind of alluded to that. I think the direction on the show is absolutely fantastic. I think one of the things I love about Succession is that it's a rare show that manages to make ostentatious wealth actually look disgusting. And actually, but, like, that's the thing, is that, like, one of those big things that you have with projects like this is the argument that it will always glorify, like, wealth and, you know, kind of, like, excess and all this sort of stuff. It's the stuff that you saw with, like, Scorsese's, well, with every gangster film ever, but with Scorsese's work in particular, with Goodfellas, with Casino, most obviously with Wolf of Wall Street, where whenever you portray terrible characters being rich, there's a tendency to make being rich look awesome. And, like, I kind of get that, because that's why people want to be rich, because being rich does allow you to do terrible stuff with no consequences whatsoever. And that is appealing to a certain person. But I also think that, like, what I admire about Succession is that it makes wealth look kind of sad and depressing and very much like a trap. Because it's because Kendall talks to his father, I think, again in the penultimate episode, and says, look, I just want to get out. And, you know, it's for Logan's, like, maybe I want to keep you close. Like, there's no escape for the family, because they, like, there's the wonderful moment in Safe Room in the second season. Like, again, the individual episodes of these are so well structured. Like, Succession does such good episodes where episodes are about particular things. And, like, a lot of modern shows, they'll just blur together and you talk about seasons. But with Succession, like, individual episodes have their recurring motifs and themes and images. So, like, things like Safe Room from the second season, which is just one of those perfect episodes of television, because everything's built around a core thematic idea. And the core thematic idea is that, like, this incredible wealth ultimately traps people. So you end up with, like, there's a gunshot in the building, and they assume it's a terrorist attack. And so everybody ends up trapped in the, like, skyscraper in this, like, ostentatious trapping of wealth. And they end up stuck together, and there's no escape from it. And it turns out that the gunshot was actually a suicide by an anchor, or by a reporter who felt trapped in their job. And you have the episode opens with Kendall walking up to the edge of the skyscraper and considering, like, jumping off and ending his own life and committing suicide. And at the close of the episode, you have a beautiful juxtaposition of a shot where, because of the gunshot panic, they've installed bulletproof glass. So he literally cannot throw himself off the building anymore, even if he chose to do so, which is amazing. But the direction generally makes wealth seem sad and lonely.
Yeah. Like, loneliness is the key term there. I think they are trapped, but they're all incredibly lonely, incredibly isolated. And, yeah, there is no warmth there. There's no joy in any of this.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a life that appeals as much as it looks like. It was all the good food and the clothes and the cars and the houses look wonderful, and all the boats and the trips and the restaurants, they look lovely, but it looks very cold and isolating.
Well, what's amazing is, and again, like, it's how much money is on screen. Like, this probably costs as much as Game of Thrones, because they fly the castle around Europe.
Yeah.
But how much of the show, like, is spent in transit. Like, how much of, like, they're in these beautiful places, they're on the Riviera, they're in Italy, but they're always, like, they're on boats, or they're in planes, or they're in cars. They're always moving. They're never actually settling or staying or enjoying. And, like, so much of it is, like, boardrooms, or, like, in the first season, hospitals. And it's often big, empty corridors. Like, the loneliness is accentuated by the choice to often shoot these spaces that are large and cavernous, and just have the cameras kind of push in on them and emphasize how small and isolated they are. Like, I would argue Succession is one of the best directed shows on television. And, like, this season had episodes directed by Lorraine Scafaria, who directed Hustlers, by Kathy Yan, who directed, like, Birds of Prey, and Mark Mylod's work. He directed 4 of the 9 episodes. He did the first 2 and the last 2. And I think he's done the season finales of like, the seasons coming up to this. Like, it really, it's very, very well directed. It's one of those shows that... That argument that I think is a Truffaut made, that you can't make an anti-war movie because any depiction of warfare is going to glorify the act of warfare, and depicting something is the same as glorifying it. And I think that's arguably true of, like, capitalism and wealth and excess, where, you know, when you show people, like, who have that much money, it will always be kind of attractive in a certain sense. But I think Succession finds a way to make it seem tasteless and sad and weird and, like, unpleasant and, like, alien and kind of sickly and not something that you would ever want to, like, even things like the amount of glass in the show, where characters are often, like, boxed in and trapped in offices and staring at their own reflection and, like, seem like they are, as you point out, in cages. It's a show that looks so good, and its visual language is so firmly tied to its themes and what it's saying. Like, it's an incredibly well-directed piece of television. And I think, you know, we don't often talk about TV direction, so I think that was worth kind of singling out if we're talking about the show.
Fab.
Sorry.
Yeah, no, that's great. I completely agree. We could probably spend another 2 hours talking about this, but I think our listeners are probably getting the point. Well, we've had plenty there. And
excessive success.
It absolutely is, yeah. So I think we'll kind of bring it to a close there. But yeah, I mean, what a season and what a show. And it's been an absolute pleasure to talk about it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Brilliant. So if you want to talk Succession or TV in general, where can we find you online?
Yes, I am available on Twitter at @Darren_Mooney. So you can come yell at me about my crazy, stupid opinions about absolutely anything, anywhere. And I will try to engage. Aside that, I write at The Escapist, which is an American website about pop culture. I do columns there on Mondays and Fridays. I do movie reviews. I occasionally do extra articles there as well. And I mean, as you mentioned at the start of the hour, I do a podcast with my good friend Andrew Quinn called The 250, where we look at the IMDb's top 250 movies of all time, one movie at a time, 1 week at a time. Do we know roughly when this is coming out?
Possibly next week, or certainly by end of December.
End of December. Okay, so our lineup in terms of December is that, well, we typically do Star Wars. So we're doing The Last Jedi. We did The Last Jedi recently. You can listen to that episode. We also do, we're starting doing Lord of the Rings to mark the 20th anniversary of The Fellowship of the Ring. So we had a discussion of The Fellowship of the Ring with Deirdre Malumbi from entertainment.ie, the wonderful Andy Milowich, the fantastic Grace Duffy. To mark Christmas itself, we will be discussing Some Like It Hot, which I would argue is kind of a Christmas movie in that it's always on at Christmas, with the wonderful Charlene Lydon and the fantastic Rena McGregor. And because it made the 250, because it was apparently the 20th best movie of all time, we will be discussing Spider-Man No Way Home as a special bonus episode that we're quite looking forward to. I haven't recorded yet. I don't know if it will beat this to the punch, but yeah, that will be kind of on the cards in terms of podcast coverage for the next little while.
Fab, looking forward to that. Yeah, I've just seen Spider-Man today, so lots of thoughts on that one. Brilliant. So yeah, thanks for joining us. And you can find me on various We Made This podcasts, including Authorized Podcast Only and Alias Podcast and the TARDIS Crew, a Doctor Who podcast I do with my son Ben, which, Darren, we're hoping to get you on as a guest fairly soon too.
I would absolutely love to.
Brilliant. And thanks for joining us for another episode. And remember, we are part of the We Made This podcast network. Please subscribe to Schedule Programming and give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. And if you want to help out our network, please consider supporting us on Patreon if you go to patreon.com/WeMadeThis. Succession is all we'll be discussing, so we'll give you a taste of what else you might have missed on the network in a moment. We'll be back soon to schedule more programming, so until then, do not adjust your set.
Elsewhere on We Made This. We are Starfleet,
a Star Trek Discovery podcast.
So it'd be a bit of a drawback as well when you're confronting other people. You know, for instance, later on when all our conversations with the president are very confrontational, right, from both sides, and it becomes a huge verbal tug of war at times, but it makes for great television. And it also makes for really good scenes for Michael Burnham. I like her being challenged. I like her having to question herself, because it makes her a much more better character, I think.
Yeah, and Michael seems to be the kind of person, like, once she makes a decision, she's not going to question that again. She's not going to second guess herself. She even says in season 3, "I would rather regret something I did than something I didn't."
Free with this month's issue.
They did this weird thing at Reading Festival one year where they got a guy and a girl up on stage with them from opposite ends of the barrier at the front. Yeah. And got them to make out for an entire song. And these people didn't know each other, because the girl was quite near me and she definitely had a boyfriend.
Oh.
But they went for it. Even at the time, I thought, this is strange.
Yeah.
Like, what's that about? You know, like, that's an odd thing to ask two strangers to do.
Probably there was a lot of pressure.
Movieversaries.
Because the trailer is full of very odd camera angles, or like odd close-ups, like too close, kind of like almost like a fisheye lens kind of look at one point. There's a whole bunch of different things that are completely bizarre.
For sure. And a lot of the cinematography, it seems like he uses lots of wide-angle lenses. And that generally, you know, if you use like a wide-angle lens for like the close-up, it gives you a sense of unease. And you see that throughout. So many wide-angle shots, and it's just like, it just makes you feel a bit weird.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network.